Good morning, Vancouver. 7:01 on a Friday. It is Halford. It is Bruff. It is Sportsnet 650. We are coming to you live from the Kintec Studios in beautiful Fairview Slopes in Vancouver. We will begin by saying good morning to Jason. Jason, good morning.
Good morning.
We will also say hello and good morning to Andy Cole, a.k.a. the A-Dog, and of course, Laddie, a.k.a. Greg Ballack.
Good morning.
Good morning, everybody. We are really coming to you live from the Kintec Studios in beautiful Fairview Slopes in Vancouver. We are in a new renovated studio. We have a new desk. We have some on-screen graphics. One day when we start streaming again, you will be able to see them. It looks very cool in here, Jason.
Normally, my mic is to the left of me, and now it's to the right. And so I'm facing right to talk into the mic, but you're to my left. Mm-hmm. So this is going to take some adjustment. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, supported by over 1,500 five-star Google reviews. Find your perfect fit at kintec.net.
I did mention that it's 7:01, now 7:02 in the morning. Why is Halford and Bruff starting an hour late, you might be asking? Well, as many of you know, it is National Day. It is the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. Radio stations across the country are coming together across Canada to amplify, elevate, listen to, and learn from Indigenous voices with A Day to Listen 2022. It's in partnership with the Gord Downie and Cheney Wenjack Fund. Listeners can tune into radio stations across the country, including all of our music stations here, Sonic 104.9 and Jack 96.9, from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. today. Listeners will hear stories from Indigenous leaders, residential school survivors, musicians, and teachers. For more information, visit adaytolisten.ca. Finally, as we run through the business of the day, I need to tell you that Halford and Bruff in the Morning is brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Three dealerships to serve you better: North Shore Acura, Acura of Langley, and Burrard Acura on Terminal Avenue. So it is an abbreviated show. We are working in a new studio. There's lots going on here that's a little off the norm, but we will still do a lot of things on a Friday that we normally do. That includes talking to Brady Henderson, ESPN, NFL Nation, our Seahawks insider at 7:30. We will look ahead to another Seahawks game. It certainly is a game.
Who are they playing this week? I've already checked out.
It is a 10 a.m. affair in Detroit against the Lions.
Ah, Detroit, okay.
Seattle is a 4-point dog on the road. We'll talk to Brady about that. We'll also look and ask a couple questions. One, can they improve the run defense? Two, can Geno Smith maybe throw the ball more than 5 to 10 yards at a time? We will ask all those questions of Brady Henderson at 7:30.
Could they make three tackles? Just three tackles.
That's all we want is three. That's it. 8 o'clock, Moj is going to join us. Bob the Moj Marjanovic. Your BC Lions are back in action. I extended the Marjanovic on that one. Yeah. BC Lions are back in action. Tonight, it is the Lions. It is the Red Blacks of Ottawa.
They better beat the Red Blacks. They better win tonight.
It was a very,
There could be a Mount Bruff if there's no win for the Lions over the Red Blacks.
It was a very, very dour affair last weekend. You came into the studio on Monday very dejected at the prospects of a Lions season. Now, without Nathan Rourke and Brian Burnham, Vernon Adams Jr. needs to play better than he did last weekend.
I feel like I've watched a lot of really inept performances offensively in the last week. And I think that's maybe because I focused a lot on the Lions game, but also that Broncos-Niners game. Like, it all felt the same.
There was some ugly football last weekend.
But the difference was it wasn't funny when the Lions were doing it.
That's true. There was no schadenfreude to be had.
Yeah, it was funny when the Broncos offense stunk and they couldn't do anything right and their fans were booing them. It was not funny when the Lions were doing it and the Lions fans were booing them.
It's actually Friday Night Football in the CFL tonight. The Banjo Bowl. Winnipeg, Saskatchewan, the battle for banjo supremacy. That's happening in the first half of the doubleheader. By the way, we don't normally do college football previews in what's happening, but I felt that this was important given your allegiance to the UW Huskies and my infatuation with our quarterback, Penix. It is a big 12 matchup, Pac-12 matchup tonight, sorry. Number 15, Washington, so they're nationally ranked now. They are 4-0. They go to UCLA to take on the 4-0 UCLA Bruins.
That's UCLA hasn't really beaten anyone of note.
Right. They're just 4-0.
UW beat Michigan State, but it's still going to be a tough one for UW.
So what else is happening tonight, you might be asking? Jays open up a series in Boston, having already clinched the playoffs. We'll talk about that. a little bit later in the program. And although we don't talk about NHL preseason that doesn't pertain to the Canucks, if you are watching Sportsnet on television tonight, you will get to watch Ottawa and Toronto play preseason hockey. It is Ask Us Anything Friday as well. Even though we're only in here for a couple hours, we will do Ask Us Anythings throughout the day, and then we'll finish off from 8:30 to 9 o'clock as well. So get them in. AUA, Ask Us Anything, and Dunbar Lumber text line 650-650.
We've already had a couple very smart texts. Kirk, the unemployed cracker factory worker, texts in, Bruff's Mike is on the opposite side, the same as Quinn Hughes playing on the right side.
Ooh.
Another one, Bruff, if Quinn can play his wrong side, you can too.
I will say the desk does make you guys look very professional.
Really?
It's doing all the work for you, of course, but I mean, it's nice.
Once we get up and streaming, people will see it is a nice desk.
It is a very nice desk.
We went from maybe the worst desk in recent memory. It was a
It was a card table.
It was too round.
Yeah.
Don't hype up the new desk too much, though. That's going to set an unreasonable expectation.
Can we do a test of the mic here? Can I go, okay, does this sound different than this?
Yes.
Ah, okay.
You sound like you're on old-time radio.
Why don't you put your microphone on the other side of the computer?
Because it doesn't stretch that far. Yeah,
there's a couple of logistical problems that we need to work out here.
Bruff doesn't want to lean in.
I'm going to have like a neck injury here or something.
What a Bruff warrior. Hasn't moved in four hours.
Do you get workers' comp if your neck cramps up?
Left side of your body is going to start going numb.
Yeah. You know, I don't like to throw around the term hero loosely, but you know, when you're talking about a guy playing through pain, that's a hero right there. Okay, I think I've told everyone what's happening on the program today, so we're all good there. Laddie, A-Dog, let's tell everybody what happened.
Hey, did you guys see the game last night?
No. What happened?
I missed all the action because I was...
We know how busy your life can be.
What happened?
Missed it?
You missed that?
What happened?
Canucks lose. Although, really, they should have won. Ryan Donato scored with 40.1 seconds left in overtime. Yeah, preseason overtime, powering the Seattle Kraken to a 4-3 comeback victory over the Vancouver Canucks on Thursday at Rogers Arena in Vancouver. That is the most amount of analysis I can give to the actual score last night. Yes, several Canucks and their head coach did seem disappointed in throwing away a 3-1 lead in a good first period.
Throwing away fake 2 points.
Right. Although getting one, the loser point. Here's the thing, and I feel bad because I know people have been starved to watch any kind of hockey, especially Canucks hockey, for a good long while. And even the slightest sliver, be it in this case preseason hockey, is something. Everyone still has to watch it with the realization that this doesn't mean anything and nobody cares. That's not a good way to go about your job, though, because you do have to care and you do have to be energized and excited about this.
Here's how I look at it.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
And this is from the king of House of Negativity.
Okay.
I try to avoid going House of Negativity at all in the preseason, and I definitely don't look at wins and losses. I just don't. Because last night, probably the biggest reason that the Canucks lost that game is because Thatcher Demko did not play the third period.
Yeah.
Okay?
Old RDC loves.
What I look at is the individual performances of the players that are going to be on the team. And last night, I have to say, I was House of Positivity. And you know why? Petey looks like Petey.
That was a big takeaway.
He looks like... You always know that Petey's on when he's drawing penalties. And how many he drew? A couple last night. He was, you know, as the kids say, doing his deeks. He was back-checking. He was really good, a two-way player, but also just an incredible performance offensively.
Mm-hmm.
That pass he made to Kuzmenko on the power play, when Kuzmenko just, you know, like had it side of the net, he's like, all right, well, dump this in. That was his easiest goal, his first goal. Kuzmenko's first goal was a great shot, and I know Andy was all excited by that.
Oh, baby.
Quinn Hughes looked good.
Quinn Hughes looked fantastic.
I don't know how long the right side of the defense experiment is going to last. I'm going to get – like, I think it looks like it's an adjustment, but he still looks good doing it. So if he can keep playing that position for, you know, a few more games or 10, 15 games, then I think he's going to get really natural at it and maybe even find some advantages to it. But regardless, Quinn Hughes looked good. He did a pivot in overtime.
Yes, I was.
That was incredible. And here's another thing. How many scoring chances did the Canucks have in overtime? Like 10?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then Pearson bobbled the puck and gave it up, and it was a breakaway the other way, and Ryan Donato, who was about the only name that I recognized in that Seattle lineup, scored a goal. So if you want to look at it in the house of negativity, feel free, right? Like, there are some good reasons to do that. Mm-hmm. The fact they did lose the game, that they definitely should have won. They should have won it in regulation. They should have won it in overtime if they hadn't won it in regulation. And also, if you look at Seattle's lineup, it wasn't good.
Yeah, look at the power play. It was just incredible.
But I just keep coming back to the Canucks' best players were the Canucks' best players. Mm-hmm. Petey was good. Hughes was good. Demko was good, right? So for me, that's the most important thing about the preseason. But I think, you know, I've actually got someone who disagrees with me, and that is the coach.
Yeah, the coach, Bruce Boudreau. Now, it was funny because we came in this morning and we go through our audio. We do diligent prep work on this show, and Laddie, a.k.a. Greg Ballack, said, I've got a couple clips where Boudreau sounds legit sad that they lost that game last night. And I was like, okay, I could kind of understand it. Some of that makes sense. Boudreau's a pretty passionate guy. He's a pretty animated guy, and I'm sure that it doesn't matter what level of competition it is. It could be a game of 4-on-4 shinny. He doesn't want his team, or if he's playing, to lose it. That's
it. It was a pretty spirited game, eh?
I think so, and I think a lot of it had to do with the lineup that Seattle iced. It's kind of designed to be...
They were a scrappy team.
Yeah, low on skill, high on scrap, right? That's kind of
the
way it
happened. The Canucks were Scooby-Doo, and they were scrappy-doo.
Yes, I think. I'm not sure. I don't know if that's the analogy, but we're going to roll with it in this particular instance. But you mentioned in the notes, even though you're like, it was very scrappy-do.
Well, there were a couple fights. There were some hits.
Yeah, John Hayden had a fight in the first period, a fight in the second period, and then a goal in the third period. Okay, before we say do the Boudreau audio, I got to say, Andy is bursting at the seams to talk about last night's game because you got to go, right? You were sitting nice and close to the ice. I saw that you were very excited to be there.
Yeah.
You got to go with your dad,
that's
which
right.
is cool,
his
right?
First game since pandemic.
Did you buy that hat last night at the game?
No,
I've seen him wear that.
Okay. I've had it for a long time.
That would have been the chef's kiss of just the overall enthusiasm.
Yeah. Did you have the foam finger?
No, I did not.
No?
Anyway.
I did have the beer hat, though.
So what were
you? You want a sip, Dad?
Sir, yeah. Did you bring that in yourself? We don't sell these here.
So before we get to Andy's analysis and enthusiasm from the game last night, let's go to the other side and hear Debbie Downer, Bruce Boudreau, after a 4-3 overtime loss to the Seattle Kraken. Let's go now.
No, I mean, that's pretty disappointing. I mean, that's what we talked about in between periods. Winning teams protect the lead. And for the most part, in the past, we were okay. But, I mean, tonight it obviously didn't get done. My biggest thing is that's, you know, two games at home against what I think were inferior lineups brought, and we didn't do what we were supposed to do to get success.
So that's a head coach talking. Even I'm like, damn, Bruce, chill. It's not that bad. But
why are you so negative all the time, Bruce?
Yeah, do you want a job here? I will say this from his perspective. This is, again, me maybe reading a little bit too much into it, but from his perspective, I think that it was very clear from the first day of training camp that it was, we're not effing around during the preseason and in camp.
Yeah, agree.
Okay? We're not going to throw together a bunch of makeshift lines where Nils Åman is playing on our top unit in the first couple of games. And he said, we're going to put together lines that at the beginning of training camp that we want to see at the start of the regular season. He played Quinn Hughes almost 30 minutes last night. Demko got two periods. There was a lot of NHL guys out there. I think that their overall sentiment is, we don't want to get off to a slow start, so we want to get not all systems firing, but a lot of the systems firing early. Now,
but are we forgetting about the quality of the Seattle lineup that had, you know, like Austin Pogansky and Ryker Evans?
I love Ryker Evans.
And Matt Tennyson and Alexander True.
Matt,
are we forgetting about those guys?
True.
Lord Tennyson, a.k.a. Matt Tennyson, spent the better part of the third period in the penalty box. He had a rough couple shifts there. Anyway.
Can you really hope to stop Will Borgen?
No. You can only hope to contain
him. I've never
heard
that name before, even last night. He wasn't even in the play sheet.
We are out of
Borgie.
We are out of Borgen lights plates.
Yes, yeah, they are. Okay. I do want to turn this into a house of positivity, and I feel like the best way to do that is to defer to A-Dog. So you're there last night.
Yeah.
And you said on this show, of which you are a fundamental part of, you're really excited about the prospects of Andre Kuzmenko this season.
Yeah, well, the whole team looked really, really good outside of the loss. I mean, obviously caveat, as you said, the lineup the Kraken iced was not good. So the Canucks had a serious advantage going into it, but man, like that power play especially, they looked dominant. Like it was like I was watching them play a WHL team at times. Like they looked fantastic. The only guys that really didn't stand out to me so much were maybe Pullman and DeKaiser, but every single other player at one point of the game in that lineup, I was like, hey, this looks pretty good. They looked excellent last night.
So we got one guy in the text message who's just furious about this. A winning culture from the beginning and at home matters, LOL. Can't believe after all this team starts the last 2 years. Guys, you're all over the place here. He says, guys don't agree with this.
I usually don't. I know his number. I usually don't read this guy's
text. Oh, really?
Yeah, I usually make a point. I can just block him if you want.
No.
The preemptive block. He's out
kind
there.
Of,
he's like,
kind
of no! No.
Listen, I've just watched so many preseasons in the past that I know what I personally look for. And I remember last year going, like, they don't look great in the individuals didn't look great in the preseason. There have been times when, for example, I've looked at a player like, remember when Michael Ferlin came and it was like early on in the season, I don't even remember if it was preseason, but you're kind of looking at the individuals and going, like, that guy doesn't look right. For me, there were a lot of good performances from Canuck key players last night. I mentioned the big three of Pettersson, Hughes, and Demko. I thought they all played well, if not really well. I was even impressed with, obviously impressed with Kuzmenko. I thought Jack Rathbone played well, and that's important for the Canucks. For me, he's a real wild card because he could be a legitimately good player. He could be if there is a possibility that he could be a legit top four defenseman this season. Now, there's a possibility that he might not, and he might end up in the AHL, but he has that upside, yep. And I think that upside was on display with that pass that he made to Petey to send him in on a breakaway. Like, there aren't a ton of defensemen that can skate like Jack Rathbone can, that can make passes like Jack Rathbone can, and can shoot the puck like he can. Mm-hmm. And he played well, and he got a lot of ice time. So, for me, that's the stuff I look at. I don't necessarily – I'm not going to sit there and go like, oh, C-Lobs has got to stop that one.
Right.
Right? Like, he's not going to be – on the NHL team. He's a young guy. He did not play well. He came in and pretty much all the goals that he allowed were questionable, even the one in OT where he wasn't aggressive enough on the granted, it was a nice play by Donato to mm-hmm. get the puck up high like that. But, you know, if Demko's in there for the third period, I'm fairly confident the Canucks win that game.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter unless it does, and it doesn't matter until someone says that it does.
What do you think of DiGiuseppe?
I think he is exactly right now what he will continue to be, which is a energy guy that can turn that and translate that into big stats and big numbers in the American League, but it'll never translate.
You don't think
to
he makes
NHL.
A team?
He'll play games.
Yeah.
I like him as a player. He's big too.
Mm-hmm.
Brendan texts in. I agree with A-Dog and the positivity. What do I not ever get credit when I'm like the one time when I come in here and I'm positive about a Canucks preseason game that they lost? Do I not get the credit?
You're being negative about A-Dog's positivity.
That's true.
Let's shine the light.
That's
on
true. Brendan says Kuzmenko looks great. Petey looked great. Quinn looked good, and then he says, but DeKaiser was pretty bad. Yeah, DeKaiser, man.
He looks slow, man.
Yeah, well, yeah, I don't think he should be on the team. Like, the one thing that I think you could say maybe even his calling card is that he might be able to help out the Canucks PK, and yet I'm not going to sit here and blame him for Seattle's first goal, which was on the power play, but it was a frustrating sequence for DeKaiser. He went out to block a shot, which you should do mm-hmm. as a defenseman. He didn't block the shot. It went out on Thatcher Demko, and then the rebound was there for the player that was behind DeKaiser then, and that player got a few whacks at it before he scored. Now, I also noticed that JT Miller could have made a play there, and he kind of had his feet in cement. And there's a few people that have texted in and said that JT Miller didn't look all that good. No, he really didn't look great. He didn't look as energetic as Petey. He didn't look as energetic as Quinn Hughes or Kuzmenko. And that's something to monitor. Not going to get too concerned about a veteran player. not looking unbelievable in the preseason, but he's going to have to ramp it up as well.
Okay, we do need to turn our attention to the National Football League now, because it was Thursday Night Football last night, and the score and result, and quite frankly, everything pertaining to the game except for one situation, paled in comparison. The Bengals did win last night, 27-15, to bring them to 2-2 and to give the Miami Dolphins their first loss of the season. But the real story was the Tua Tagovailoa injury and subsequent carting off of the field. So Joe Burrow tossed a 2-yard touchdown late to seal the victory for the Bengals in a Thursday night game, but everything was marred by a pretty upsetting sight. Dolphins quarterback Tua Tagovailoa being taken off on a stretcher. And prior to that, prone in what's known as the fencing response. So for those that are unaware, the fencing response is that very unnatural position where your arms or extremities almost curl up following a concussion. You know what I'm talking about? It's often been called is like the dinosaur arms or the T-Rex arms.
That was awful to watch, man.
It is
awful.
Essentially what happens is immediately after any sort of moderate force has been applied to the brainstem, your forearms, or in this case fingers, are held flexed or extended, which is why Tua's fingers look so unnatural in the, and I will point this out, numerous replays that the Amazon crew decided to show of that, when the current landscape kind of suggests stop showing less of potentially traumatic injuries on replay. They showed it numerous times. And now the conversations really begin. Because, of course, this is the same Tua Tagovailoa who was removed from a game 4 days ago, 5 days now, because it's Friday, where it appeared that he suffered a traumatic brain injury, which was classified as the Dolphins as a back injury, right? That happened on Sunday against the Bills. Now, I'm going to throw the audio to Dolphins head coach Mike McDaniel, because he reiterated as such in his post-game explanation that going into Thursday Night Football, the entire Dolphins organization was working on the assumption, through medical advice, that Tua did not suffer a brain injury on Sunday, was not put into concussion protocol, that he was dealing with a back injury, and then on Thursday, he suffered the concussion. Now, say what you will about whether or not you believe it. I think it's important that we play the audio. Here now is Dolphins head coach Mike McDaniel on why Tua was available on Thursday Night Football.
Yeah, otherwise we would have reported him having a head injury. I mean, that's why the NFL has these protocols, and there's not, like, every single NFL game that is played, there's an independent specialist that specializes in the specialty of brain matter. So, for me, as long as I'm coaching here, if there's any, you know, I'm not going to fudge that whole situation. If there's any sort of inclination that someone has a concussion, they go into the concussion protocol, and it's very strict. If people don't vary or stray, we don't mess with that. Never have, and as long as I'm the head coach, that will never be an issue that you guys have to worry about.
So I think someone's going to have to lay out the timeline for the last week. What happened with Tua in the second to last game, not last night? Just lay out the timeline and what the doctors said and get people on the record, because right now people don't trust the Miami Dolphins.
No, and I feel bad for McDaniel, because he's clearly going up there with the information presented to him from the club, from the team's medical advisors, right?
Yeah.
Because Tua wasn't put in the kind of concussion protocol that he would have needed to have held him on a Thursday's game. He was listed with a back injury.
Well, the NFLPA called for an investigation.
Yeah, I've got the statement here. This is from last night from the NFLPA. Player health and safety is at the core of the union's mission. Our concern tonight is for Tua, and we hope for a full and speedy recovery. Our investigation into the potential protocol violation is ongoing. So make it clear, they're not satisfied with the way that the first potential brain injury was handled on Sunday. They're investigating that, but in the midst of this investigation, the player was still allowed to go and suit up on Thursday Night Football.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is an inherent issue. Now, look, I get that football is a violent sport, and I get that Tua Tagovailoa was probably pushing to get out there as much as anybody, because that's how a lot of competitive athletes are hardwired. And I'm sure that the coaching staff can turn around and say, look, I can only work with the information that's given me. But it feels like there's a real gap in the system here, where a guy that clearly had some sort of neurological problem on Sunday was back out there on Thursday, and then the first time his head hit the turf in a violent fashion, he went into the fencing response.
Well, it was sure a violent fashion. And some people will say, well, maybe it's just a coincidence. Maybe it just happened to happen 2 weeks in a row, or
four days apart.
Yeah, but you know, I'm not one of those people. I think that would maybe be too much of a coincidence. But hey, get this investigation going and hear from Tua. What was he saying? And hopefully he's honest. Because I think I'm like most people in that game against the Bills. I'm like, that didn't look like a back injury.
No, it absolutely
did not. That looked like a guy that had a concussion. And then he came out and he played. And then 5 days later, you know, it was he was pretty violently flung to the ground. But perhaps maybe I even thought this, like, could he have, I don't know, like, it looked like he didn't have the wherewithal to almost like fight that tackle off, if that makes sense. You know, like, it looked like he was a rag doll out there.
It was very interesting.
And I just wonder if he hadn't had that injury last week, would he have looked like such a rag doll out there?
Well, the play prior to getting hurt, it was actually a 15-yard roughing the passer penalty on Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those ones where the guy dove in low, but Tua kind of crumpled. And I saw some
people, maybe that was related to
it. I saw some people saying, like, they should have got him out of there at that point because he didn't look right. And even if it's just the lower body thing, but even if it's a lower body thing, given how fragile he's been through the first 2 weeks, I say fragile because he has a bunch of injuries besides whatever neurological issue was going on. It looked like that was a guy that maybe needed to be out of that game at that point. And then it got fundamentally worse after that.
Well, maybe let's say that there really was a back injury in the Bills game, maybe that kept him from, you know, maybe that made him more vulnerable.
Well,
you know, I just have a lot of questions at this point, and I would like to see it laid out for me. I'm sure Dolphins fans would like to see it laid out for them. Just give one of those timelines. Okay, so Tua gets hurt against the Bills. Then what happens? Who did he talk to? What was he saying? What was the determination? Then go into this week. How is he feeling? And then what happened last night, obviously. I think this is what people want. They want some accountability here before a lot of people are giving judgment. Anyway, before the final judgment comes in. Brady Henderson is going to join us next. We'll talk a little Seahawks football. And then we will return to last night's Canucks game for the second part of the next segment. Any comments, questions, text them into the Dunbar Lumber text line at 650-650. It is Ask Us Anything Friday on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650.
Got return with their highly anticipated new studio album, The End So Far. 12 explosive new tracks, including the lead single, The...
I'm looking at the NFLPA. Get your investigation going. Keep pushing. The NFL do the same thing. Find out what the hell went on. And guess who else I'm holding accountable to some degree? His teammates.
.734 on a Friday. Halford Brough, Sportsnet 650. I was fiddling with my headset there prior to coming back from break. What did we play there? Was that some Stephen A. Smith on Tua Tagovailoa, laddie?
Correct.
Halford and Brough in the Morning is brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today by visiting your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. The NFL talk rolls on here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. Joining us now, as he does every Friday to preview the Seahawks game, it is Brady Henderson from ESPN here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. Good morning, Brady. How are you?
Hey, good morning, fellas. Doing great. How are you?
We're good. Thanks for taking the time to do this. We appreciate it. I'm curious how big a talking point this week during practice was the Seahawks' ability or lack thereof to stop the run?
That was the number one talking point, I would say, yeah. And just among players and coaches, and that was the big question that we were asking them, just because I think that's been not far from their only issue, but really their biggest issue on defense. You know, when you think about the way that that game played out Sunday, you know, they go and they kick the field goal to go up 23-20, I believe it was. You need a stop there, and your defense gives up, what, a 40-yard run to Cordarrelle Patterson. Not that that was the only play that they gave up, but just that was, I think, the big one against the run, and they've had a few of those. And, you know, one of the worst rush defenses in the NFL. It was a problem, you know, last week, or the week before against San Francisco. And, you know, I think the way that they had the two goal line stands against Denver really masked a lot of the issues they had against the run in that game too, with the missed tackles and everything. So yeah, it's been a big problem. I think it's easy just to point to the fact that they've got a lot of young players, but that's, I don't think that's the only issue either. And Uchenna Nwosu, to his credit, he's been great so far this season as a pass rusher, but you know, he took the blame for allowing the big cutback lane on that 40-yard Cordarrelle Patterson run. You know, Daryl Taylor missed a tackle in the backfield against Deebo Samuel that, you know, allowed him to get free on that long run of his. And he's, you know, a third-year guy. So this is not just young players. I think it's a combination of young players, a new scheme that guys are still sort of ironing out, and the fact that, you know, they've played some good rushing offenses as well.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of answered my question there, but I was going to ask you, like, what does it boil down to? Why are they having so much trouble stopping the run? There's probably a few answers. Maybe the getting used to the new scheme. I mean, missed tackles is obviously an issue for this team. Feels like they've got to work on a few things in order to solve this problem.
Yeah, the missed tackles, that was, to me, that looked like a big one in the first couple games. You know, there was a number of times where Javonte Williams just bounced off guys in the first game. You know, the big Deebo Samuel run in the second game was, that was the big play there. There was a number of other missed tackles. The game on Sunday against Atlanta, that didn't feel like a missed tackle issue so much as it felt like just that there was too much space that they were allowing in the run game. And the, you know, the big Cordarrelle Patterson run was an example of that. You know, Uchenna Nwosu, the key was so preoccupied with trying to contain Marcus Mariota and being worried about, you know, him getting out on a bootleg keeper that he just left this wide open cutback lane. You know, the big, I think an issue that they're having right now is the way that the defensive linemen and the linebackers are playing with one another, and the fact that those two groups are just leaving too much space, and they're just not playing with what they're not playing off of each other the way that they should. And to me, that signals, you know, kind of some of the newness that they're experiencing right now. And, you know, I think that gets amplified when not only are you installing a new scheme, but you are, you know, doing that without playing a lot of your guys in the preseason. There's one fewer preseason game. And so you figure that, you know, now is kind of the time that they start to turn that around. They start to figure it out. I think, you know, not having Shelby Harris for really the past two games has hurt them as well. So, you know, this defense has turned things around the past couple seasons in a big way after some pretty brutal starts. It shouldn't take a turnaround like that. But I think the encouraging part is that they have done it before where they kind of find their footing, but it's looking like they're going to have to do that again this year.
Listen, I don't know how many Seahawks fans have realistic playoff hopes for this team, but they're 1-2 and the division doesn't look incredible this season. But these next two games at Detroit and at New Orleans, they're probably going to be betting underdogs in them. I think they're a 4-point dog in Detroit, but if they've got any hopes of making the playoffs or at the very least staying in the race, they got to win at least one of these and then return home for a game against Arizona. It just seems like last week's win, like that's a game they got to win. You know, they're at home against not a very good team. They find a way to lose it. What's the feeling around the Seahawks right now? Because it was so, things were so great after that week one win against the Broncos. Then there was a very disappointing performance down against the 49ers. And then this, I would say, equally disappointing loss to the Falcons.
Yeah, and I really wonder, and you know, Pete Carroll has said this, John Schneider has said this as well, and I wondered this even before they said it, that, you know, if there was kind of the best term I can come up with is like an emotional hangover in San Francisco from that Monday night game. It was a short week. that win meant a lot to a lot of people in that organization. And even they're even admitting it too. They're not giving you the full story there, but you can imagine why that win meant so much to them. Not just the fashion that they won it in, but the player, you know, the quarterback that they won it against. You know, I think that win took a lot out of them emotionally. And I don't know if they had, you know, I don't know if they were able to really recharge their emotional batteries on a short week. And I think that's some, you saw a product of that to some degree in San Francisco. You know, against Atlanta, they didn't really have an excuse. There's no excuse I can come up with for getting beat like that, you know, in a game that, as you said, and I agree that they should have won there. You know, I nobody is saying this, but I just think that it, and I think I mentioned this on your show before too, that I just think that games are going to go like that for them this season, where they are good enough to hang with teams and they're going to be in positions to win games. And they're going to need a late drive by Geno Smith at the end. And they're just not going to be able to do it because Geno Smith he's a good quarterback. You're seeing that he's a capable quarterback, but there's a very discernible, a very distinct skill that it takes to pull games out at the end like that. And you saw it so often from Russell Wilson. It's a mental thing as much as it is a physical thing. And it's hard to pull games like that at the end when there's that much pressure and when defenses are, you know, they are so dialed in and defensive coordinators are throwing everything at you. And you saw that, you know, they were not able to win those three chances that they had late last season last season when Wilson was out, and they weren't able to do it in this game. So I just have a feeling that you're going to see more games like that where they play well enough to be in the game, but they just can't pull it out at the end.
I think it's a play-calling thing to a certain degree, too, because you mentioned earlier in our conversation, we're speaking to Brady Henderson from ESPN's NFL Nation here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. Brady, you mentioned earlier in our conversation, you didn't mention the decision, but you said the Seahawks kicked a field goal late to make it 23-20, and then the Falcons came back and scored the touchdown, 27-23 final. I saw a fair amount of criticism, I think rightly so, that the Seahawks opted to kick the field goal in that position when a little bit more of an aggressive call could have seen them go for the end zone on fourth down, or at least try and get the first down. If I'm not mistaken, it wasn't down to go and goal. You know, you look at Geno Smith so far, and you really can't have too many complaints about what he's done. Last week, he threw for over 300 yards and two touchdowns. He's completing close to 80% of his passes. If anything, I'd say Smith is the least of the problems that the Seahawks have had. You knew what he was going to be, albeit a limited quarterback. He's probably exceeded your expectations a little bit, but, you know, for the approach for them to have that they had, I just thought it was underwhelming and a little disappointing, because if they're going to win games, they're going to have to be more aggressive than that. I don't think they can manage their way to victory.
Yeah, I agree with what you said on Geno. He has been better than I expected. He's been really efficient. The big criticism that I would have had after the first two games is that there's just not enough downfield offense, and that you can't, it's hard to win games like that when you're just throwing short and intermediate, and they found more of a deep passing game against Atlanta. So I think that's encouraging. And I agree with you on the play calling. I don't know if that was necessarily the wrong decision. What I do know is that kicking a field goal there with the way that their defense has been playing, it put a lot of faith in a defense that frankly has not earned it.
Right.
Certainly did not earn it in the week before against San Francisco when they allowed 27 points and was not earning it to that point against the Falcons. And, you know, you saw what happened next. The Falcons drove and scored the go-ahead touchdown that ended up being the game-winning touchdown. And it was very predictable that they were going to score a touchdown on that next drive. And so I understand the decision to call a timeout there. And the word that we got from Pete Carroll and from Geno Smith was that, you know, when they kept the offense out on the field to run that 4th-and-2 play, you know, they were going to go for it. That was not a situation where they were just going to try to, you know, draw Atlanta offside. Like, they were going for it. They were intent on running a play. And then they realized that they were sort of out of whack and they were not ready based on something that happened on the previous play. They just weren't ready to run that play. So calling the timeout there is understandable, even though you know that it's, you know, you may need that timeout later. I think it's better to call a timeout there than to burn 5 yards. What I don't understand is not sending your offense back out on the field after calling that timeout. And my theory, and you know, Pete Carroll was coy about this, wouldn't really tell us a whole lot. My theory is that part of the reason they felt like they had an advantage of going for it was because they were going no huddle on that drive. And so maybe felt like the defense was tired, wasn't able to sub in. So they were kind of dictating personnel, dictating the tempo. And then once you stop the clock, well, the defense gets a chance to catch its breath, gets a chance to swap in players, get their own personnel in there. So maybe they felt like after the timeout, the advantage they had in going for it was not there. Either way, it was a curious decision, and it ended up being, I think, a costly one.
I can't imagine what Pete Carroll really thinks about his team right now, because this is not his kind of team. You know, the defense isn't very good, and they can't run the ball either. I know they haven't tried to run the ball all that much, and a lot of that is because, you know, like, again, for example, in the San Francisco game, they were down early and by a lot, so obviously you're not going to keep running in that game. But, you know, if you look at their average yards per attempt, it's in the bottom third of the NFL. Is that something that was talked about this week?
That has not been as big of a talking point. It's been more so about the passing game and the run defense, but that is odd. I agree with you. And, you know, you just, what was the one thing you could count on going into the season is that you didn't know what the defense is going to be like. You didn't know what Geno Smith was going to look like, but you figured that they were going to run the hell out of the ball because that's what Pete Carroll wants to do. But they haven't really done that. And I think, you know, in the San Francisco game, you can understand it just because, you know, they hardly had the ball in that game. There just weren't that many plays, and they were in catch-up mode because they got behind, you know, by a lot early, and they had to throw it. But, yeah, they ran, what, 50, 60 plays in the Atlanta game. And,
yeah,
you know, they still didn't run the ball a whole lot. So, you know, I would it is curious, especially because, you know, they're facing so many two deep looks. And Pete Carroll has talked about this, and it's an obvious point that, you know, the way that you get defenses out of the two deep looks, which thus, you know, then that opens up more of your deep passing game, is you throw the ball underneath a lot, which is what they've been doing, and you also run the ball. In order to kind of suck that safety up who's playing deep, you get one of those guys to play in the box. And so I'm just surprised that they really only tried to do that by throwing the ball underneath a lot, and they haven't run it as much. I wonder if Ken Walker III, if his kind of slowed progress is hampering that a little bit. You know, he's only played, I think, 11, and he's only played a small hand. I don't know the exact numbers, but he has not played a whole lot over the first couple games. Remember, he missed the first one. Mm-hmm. And I just don't know if they want to give the ball to Rashad Penny a ton, knowing that he's just not built to carry the ball 25 times a game like some running backs are. So that's something that I imagine has to change, you know, especially as Ken Walker III gets his feet wet. You know, you've seen him kind of run the wrong way a couple times on a run play. You could just tell he's not really totally with the program yet in terms of getting up to speed with the offense and everything. So I imagine that's going to change. You're going to see them run the ball more at some point soon.
It is the Seahawks. It is the Detroit Lions this Sunday, 10 a.m. kickoff from Detroit. Seahawks are 4-point dogs on the road. Brady, thanks for doing this, bud. We appreciate it. Enjoy the game this weekend. We'll do this again next Friday.
All right, fellas. Thank you. See ya.
Yep, that. Thank you as well. That's Brady Henderson from ESPN's NFL Nation, our Seahawks insider here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650.
So I said that we'd do a little Canucks talk and also some Ask Us Anythings. How about both at the same time here?
Ooh.
Ask you guys anything from Iron Blair. And he says, this is how I want to see the defensive pairings. And he asks us, do you agree? Now, he's got Hughes and OEL on the top pair, which it was. He's got Hughes on the left side and OEL on the right side. I don't know if that was intentional, or let's just go guys together here and not worry about left and right. So he's got Hughes and OEL. He's got Myers and Kyle Burrows, and then he's got Shen with Rathbone.
So he's got no Pullman and no Dermott.
And no DeKeyser.
No DeKeyser, which is fine.
As well. So here's the thing for me. If they're going to go with Hughes and OEL, I'm fine with that. Try that out. See how it goes. Have Hughes on the right side and then kind of revisit it, I don't know, after 10 games or 5 games, whatever you want to do. Let's just go with that. I also really like Shen and Rathbone as a potential third pairing. We've seen what Shen did with Quinn Hughes. There should, in theory, be a stylistic match. So let's see that on the third pair. The second pair for me is where I absolutely throw up my hands and go, I don't know. You know, Myers is going to be there. So who's best with him? I think it's probably going to be Dermott.
I think so too.
But Dermott's not healthy right now. I don't really want to see DeKaiser signed. Yeah. You know, like I
don't think you need to worry about that.
I'd prefer right Burrows over Pullman, to be honest, if I had to pick between the two at this point. Give me more Burrows.
This is how.
Yeah, I think people like Burrows
this
too,
is,
right?
I think this is how the whole season's going to play out, though. It's going to be a rotating cast because they've really got seven guys that can do the job of six. Like, you could say, well, maybe you throw Burrows in the mix, or maybe Pullman gets in the mix, and don't forget about Dermott. And if they do sign DeKaiser, he's the eighth or ninth defenseman. General rule of thumb, this dates back to the Lawrence Gilman days, was if you're a Western Conference team with a lot of travel and guys wear down, your defense needs to go minimum of 10 deep, right? So you need your six, and then you need a bunch of NHL caliber guys, and I'm using caliber loosely here, but that can go in and fill the role. Dermott, to me, is the purpose of this exercise, Dermott, to me, is the most logical one for the top four, if only because I think he might be, outside of Quinn Hughes, the best skater in the group. He can move, and I think that can compensate
Rathbone's a good skater.
Yeah, I think that it can compensate for a lot of issues. I think you can mask a lot of issues too if you can move and you can get to certain places.
But do we agree that that second pair is the key? Because if the second pair is not up to task, whoever Myers is playing with, which is probably going to be the case, right? If that second pair isn't up to task, then they might have to explore splitting up OEL and Hughes, and then you put OEL back together with Myers, and then you have Hughes with whoever, and you just hope that Hughes can carry that pairing by himself. Again, my rule of thumb is that if you have two pairs that you're confident in and that you feel good about, then you're sitting pretty. The problem is, the Canucks right now, I don't see two pairs that I feel great about. Myers and Dermott, like, okay, maybe. If you're asking Rathbone to be a top four defenseman and play legitimate minutes against legitimate competition, I'm hopeful that one day he'll be able to do that, but I don't know if you want to rush him into that position right now. So that, for me, is the wild card. It's just the second pair. I have every confidence in the world that Hughes and OEL will be able to hold up their end of the bargain. But the question is going to become, do you have to start spreading those guys out because you've got a problem on the second pair?
You know what I liken it to, and I think the defense is going to end up being like this year? Of course, there's a Simpsons reference for everything. Do you remember when Marge buys the pink Chanel suit on discount?
Oh, yeah.
The discount
she just
store?
Keeps,
and then she just keeps altering it and retailing it and re-altering it to look like a different outfit.
And then eventually it just dissolves, doesn't it?
Right.
It just falls apart.
And then, so the rest of the NHL would be the Springfield Country Club where you're trying to fit in. You're like, look, I also have a top four defense. And then Marge is Boudreaux. See, I'm putting this all together in my mind.
Is Hughes the Chanel suit?
And I don't know. Maybe. I don't know if it's a collective.
Well, if you move Hughes around with a bunch of different D
pairs,
I
think that might be
none
it.
Of them
yeah.
work, and it gets worse and worse and worse. Eventually, it's just Hughes hanging by a thread.
I think that's what it is, though, because at this stage of the game, you've got all these pieces, and you've got a defense. You just need to constantly alter it and re-alter it. And I think some of it, honestly, might be based on matchups, and eventually, some of it will be based on health. Because you know injury's going to hit at some point.
Oh, we got a text in. I like J-Bone with Shen, but then you've locked him in on the third pair. You're looking for some magic to create a second pair out of nothing. Explore other options for Jack. Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that's why Rathbone is actually such a key player for the Canucks this season. Because if I look at all those defensemen that they have, for the most part, you know what you got, right? Like, you know what you got with... You know what you got with Tyler Myers? You know what you got with Kyle Burrows and Luke Shen? I guess Travis Dermott is like a quasi wild card because we haven't really seen what he can do. But I don't think he's got a super high ceiling. Rathbone is the one with the highest ceiling. The question is, can he get there? And number two, if he can, how quickly?
Are we sure that if you lock in J-Bone, which is a great nickname, by the way, with Shen, that you are locking him into the third pair? Because
he just quietly moved them up to the second pair.
Look at last year. How often was Luke Shen in the top four? He was a second pair defenseman for long stretches of play. Now, it's apples and oranges with regards to Shen and Hughes as opposed to Shen and Rathbone. But, my overall sentiment on this blue line is don't lock anything in anywhere and be prepared for constant alterations.
Lock in Hughes on the top pair.
Yeah, okay, you can lock in that. That'll be the top button on the Chanel dress, but everything else is it's up for alteration.
Did you see how much he played last night? He played almost half the game.
Well, I referenced that.
It's a preseason game.
I referenced that off the top when we were talking about how serious Boudreaux was taking this preseason. Yeah. I mean, you don't have to play Quinn Hughes 30 minutes in a preseason game against Seattle's AHL.
Six
roster.
Minutes was on the power play, right? And that's just fun time for Quinn Hughes,
but
right?
Minutes are minutes. I mean, that's a lot. Even in an overtime game, and
well, get used to it. He needs to play a lot.
Yeah, and I think he's going to as well. Okay, we are up against it for time. We only have 1 hour left on the Helford and Bruff Show on Sportsnet 650, 8 o'clock hour. We're going to talk to Moj, Bob the Moj Marjanovic. Look ahead to tonight's game between the Lions and the Red Blacks. It's the second of a CFL doubleheader, so we'll talk to Moj about that. We can ask him about some NFL previews. So we should ask him about Tua Tagovailoa as well, and the situation with the Miami Dolphins on Thursday Night Football, and to his concussion and how it was handled. We will also do Ask Us Anythings in the final half hour of the program, so get yours in. Hashtag them AUA. That does stand for Ask Us Anything. It's your chance to be on the radio. The Dunbar Lumber text line is 650-650. We've got 1 hour left, so don't go anywhere. It's the Helford and Bruff Show on Sportsnet 650.